Hello, Karen.
Carl, good morning.
Welcome to A Life in Biography. I'm speaking with Karen Christensen, who is an author, an editor, a publisher. What else should I say, Karen?
A reluctant biographer.
Okay. Well, that'll be a first. No one's ever described themselves as a reluctant biographer.
That's how I guess I'm feeling this morning. I was looking at all the biographies that you've written and thinking about the patterns, because that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to ask you about your biographies. And I thought, I'm never writing another one. Once I finish this one, forget it.
Well, I've heard that before. There are a lot of biographers who've written one biography, don't even describe themselves as biographers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, actually, a lot of people. Lewis Mumford wrote one biography. William McNeill wrote one biography of, you know, of somebody who was obviously of great importance to them. I don't think they ever looked for another subject. But you have written on so many fascinating people. But I've been thinking about what, you know, and asking myself what all those, you know, your not just your subjects, but your approach, what's common there and what I can learn from it. And that's what, when I suggested that we do a podcast where I could ask you questions, that's what I had in mind.
Sure, that sounds great.
To probe more deeply, because it does seem to me that you tackled questions, and perhaps even more and more as time went on, that that sometimes offended people, because there is this sort of very gentlemanly idea that even today that one should be discreet and one should not probe too deeply, and you obviously haven't taken that approach.
Yeah, I think that the great biographers, some of the great biographers anyway, like Boswell and James Anthony Froude in his biography of Carlyle, are indiscreet. And
yes.
and both were attacked for that.
Yes. And I remember, because you quote in your stories about writing, about being a biographer, you both quote positive reviews, but negative ones. And one that I liked was something about, you know, that one of your biographies was a mix of the sort of the academic with the tabloid or the People magazine, sort of tacky probing and
yeah. Well, for my the last 10 years of my career, I was in a journalism department. That is my teaching career. And I used to joke about, I was really sorry that no one had endowed a chair for me, and they could have called me the professor of tabloid journalism or something like that.
Yes, yes. And so you can be criticized for being too academic, and I think have been, or for being too tabloid.
Yeah.
But, what I wanted to get you to explain is why you probe deeply into areas that people obviously feel some of your both subjects and the people you've interviewed have felt uncomfortable about, and yet we know they're important, sex and money in particular.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should begin by saying that unlike some biographers, and I think this is particularly true of modern and contemporary biographers, if it's a literary subject or even a political subject, for example, the biographer will say, well, I'm interested in so-and-so because of his or her achievement. And if that person had never written, of course, there would be no biography. I don't happen to believe that. I would never write about somebody who I didn't think was intrinsically interesting as a person. I think all individuals are. It just depends on who's telling their story and what they see. I had a next door neighbor who was not a writer, wasn't renowned in any sense. And yet I found him a fascinating person, probably no one would publish my biography of him. But that's sort of the point I'm trying to make, whether the subject is Rebecca West or Martha Gellhorn or Marilyn Monroe, although in her case, it's almost a kind of reversal. I was interested in her life because it seemed powered by her desire to be an actor. So I don't like to separate those two things. And I think that separation in biographical subjects is really it's only happened really since the late 19th, early 20th century. If you look at the 18th century and earlier, there was no such separate distinction between the life and the work. If you look at Samuel Johnson, for example, his Life of Savage, the poet Savage, it's mostly about Savage's life. Johnson does talk a bit about his work, but he says, this man is remarkable for both what he achieved and what he suffered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you look at the life and the things that are the motivators, the things that give people the greatest pleasure and cause the greatest pain. Because those are their real lives. But can you, perhaps there's something that comes to mind in terms of your probing about money or your probing about sex that would be interesting for other biographers, new or experienced, to know, because I do think you are quite a bit bolder than many. You know, if someone, I notice that if someone doesn't answer the question fully, you certainly make an effort to you're quite dogged.
I guess that's true. I guess what I'm trying to aim at is a real visceral sense of the subject, what this person was like as a person. And it seems to me you can only do that through looking at all facets and the most intimate facets of their lives, if you can possibly find out about those. And I've been fortunate, maybe because I keep looking for these things, but with subjects like Rebecca West and William Faulkner, I found, you know, remarkable accounts of their lives, which included certainly sex and money.
Mm-hmm. You've had some pushback. I think I can think of a couple cases that you mentioned where you found that someone had an affair with a particular person. I think it was Martha Gellhorn and H.G.
Wells, yeah.
And people don't put that in. I mean, I assume you've had quite a lot of don't put that in.
Yes, I have. In Gellhorn's case, she denied a relationship with Wells and said that he was fantasizing about her. They certainly did have a friendship. She lived in his house for a brief period as well. And, you know, when I looked at Wells, and I was quite familiar with Wells because of his affair with Rebecca West, I never saw any evidence of him embroidering or fantasizing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see that at all. What I saw was Gellhorn wanting to get past a certain stage in her own career and not wanting to talk about such things. And of course, feeling that it's an invasion of privacy. But in her letters, she certainly talked about her love life. She talked about it with the art historian, Bernard Berenson, for example. Mm-hmm. And so when my subjects talk about that, and in some sense, see it as a subject important to me, I can't see why in the world, as a biographer, I wouldn't also do the same thing.
And do you think that this, I mean, how do you feel about this idea of someone's right to control their own story? People clearly want to control their own story.
Yeah. I don't think they have any right to be blunt, because that I look at in one way or another have been public figures. And it's not just that they've been public figures that others know about them, but it's that they've projected a certain image, a persona. And if they have a right to project that kind of image of them, and influence the way people think about them, why wouldn't a biographer be able to inquire into that whole mechanism? I mean, that's what my wife and I were doing with the Susan Sontag biography when we called it The Making of an Icon. It wasn't, oh, let's dig up all about Susan Sontag, although some reviewers tried to portray the book that way. It was, how do you get to be Susan Sontag? And it turns out that, you know, she had a certain plan. She had a certain strategy that she didn't want people to know about. And that's what the work of biography is about.
And that's what is incredibly interesting. I must say that as a reader, that makes the character much more interesting, but it makes them more human and more complex. And it's not only the individual who wants to be an icon, but they're often surrounded by other people, aren't they, who want to preserve
that. And I've noticed with some readers and some reviewers, they have a certain image of the subject that I'm writing about. And when I present, in a sense, the details that don't match that image, that's very upsetting. And then they try to find words for my work, makes them feel better by rejecting me. I'm thinking of a review of my Lillian Hellman biography in which the book reviewer said it was dishy. And I presume by that she meant gossipy. I was, you know, saying things about this playwright and autobiographer and screenwriter and so on. And I was presenting, I suppose, these, what the reviewer called, would have thought of as these trivial details. The interesting thing about that, I say about this sometime, is that I couldn't talk to anybody who knew Lillian Hellman who didn't want to talk about sex, didn't want to talk about her craving for money. There wasn't anybody, I don't care. And I mean, I talked to her lover, talked to her, you know, actors in her plays, people like Walter Matthau, for example, Haywood Heilbrun, all kinds of people. And it was remarkable how, if you want to use the word dish, how they wanted to dish and talk. So entertaining, sometimes so infuriating. And I wanted to get that all in the book. So if you look at that book, and then you look at some of my other books, you wouldn't call my books, my biographies, dishy, but that does apply to the Hellman book because it applies to her. It's extraordinary, the kind of presumption to biography. There was at least one review of the Hellman biography that deplored the fact that I talked physically. Everybody I interviewed talked about the way she looked physically, that she wasn't by any conventional standard, you know, conventionally pretty woman. And yet how successful she was sexually and having affairs and so on. So much testimony about that. And one of the reviewers said, oh, he's interested in that because he's a biographer of Marilyn Monroe. And she's interested. Well, that's just absurd. I mean, how do you know, you were talking about the connections between, how do you get from Marilyn Monroe and Lillian Hellman and Rebecca West, Amy Lowell and William Faulkner? I mean, I wrote all those books, and all those books are not the same because my subject. So this confusion between the biographer and the subjects is, you know, quite, I mean, there was a review in the Wall Street Journal, a very good review of my Rebecca West biography, and the biographer was scratching his head. How could someone write a biography of Rebecca West and also write a biography of Marilyn Monroe? Well, to me, that reflects a fundamental misunderstanding about biography. Not the fact, not, you know, and I could go on to say, for instance, both Marilyn Monroe and Rebecca West, who started out as an actress, were performative personalities. They loved to perform. And that's what my books are partly about.
That does seem to me as certainly one common thread of this thing of controlling your own life, but creating your life, your identity. I was very much amused to read about Lillian Hellman's making up parts of her life, because I thought that was a rare thing. I've been dealing with Valerie Elliott, T.S. Eliot's second wife, and I was shocked when I discovered that she told stories that weren't true or were wildly exaggerated. I thought that was something unusual, and now I'm starting to think that it's more common than not.
It's common, and of course, biographies have to be careful because the people you're interviewing may also be making up stories about your subject, and yes. That's where you've got to look at your other interviews. You do have to look at patterns. If there are documents, you have to look at documents. Both Lillian Hellman and Joe Craigie, for example, didn't tell the truth about when they were born. That's very funny to me, because when I met Joe Craigie, this is before I knew I was going to do her biography, and she was asking me about what I had done and what I had learned. And I said, well, I just, finished a biography of Lillian Hellman, and I was, intrigued by the fact that she changed her birth date several times. And Craigie said to me, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. And she was sort of saying, a woman has to protect herself, and in certain industries, your age is really important. And if you shave off a few years, so what? I didn't realize that Craigie was describing herself.
Have you ever had anyone deny what they've told you?
Yes. This happened with my biography of Norman Mailer. I recorded an interview with William Styron, and he had a very conflicted relationship with Norman Mailer. They had not spoken for years, and then there was a rapprochement, and they were the best of pals. And when Styron agreed to do an interview, and he's interesting because he wouldn't do an interview for Hellman because she told him, don't talk to anybody except my authorized biographer. So for whatever reason, Styron felt, I don't think he felt he owed me something, but I think he wanted to show he was certainly willing to talk about people he knew. And so he told me this fantastic story about Norman Mailer and an editor that both he and Mailer had, who had stabbed, I can't remember now, it's in my book, either not his wife, I think it was a girlfriend. And Mailer said, after this happened, he said to Styron, I wish I had the guts to do that. It's an incredible statement.
Yes.
And Styron actually told this to another biographer, Hillary Mills, and she didn't tell the whole story because I think she realized that if she put that in the book, it would be really explosive.
Yeah.
But I knew that he had told this to Hillary Mills, and then he told it to me, and I put it in the book. Mm-hmm. And when The Galleys came out of the book, the New York Post called me up, this the famous Page Six column. They're always looking yes. for sensational stuff. And they said, well, what's new in your book? And I told them this story, which I thought was quite remarkable for, I connected to all kinds of things in my biography. And so what does Page Six do? And I certainly can't fault them for this. They call up Styron, and Styron says, oh, I never said that. This is a case of a biographer sensationalizing what I said. So the Page Six journalist calls me back and he says, Styron denies all this. I said, well, he can do that if you want. I have the recording.
Yes.
And it's in my archive now at the University of Tulsa. And I think he was embarrassed because Mailer also claimed he had never said this. And so here Styron, as far as I could see, was in a kind of a jam. And to get out of it, what easier thing to do than to blame the messenger?
Now, I'm really surprised that you've been able to record people so consistently, because I've been very nervous about asking people, because I've seen how antsy people get of being recorded. And I've really felt it was going to interfere with their speaking freely.
Yeah. Well, I don't always record people, of course, and some people don't want to be recorded. And they say that before I interview them. I never ask them. I don't hide the tape recorder, but what I do is, or whatever the recording machine is, it's digital now, or an iPhone even. I just place it, if we're meeting in a restaurant or I'm meeting in their home or wherever, you know, I come and sit down and we have a little casual conversation and I whip out my recording device and I put it on the table or on the chair or wherever I happen to be. And then it's up to them to say yes or no. And I try to make it as natural as possible. And if the issue ever comes up, I go off and say, well, look, this is for my benefit and yours. If there's any, you know, misunderstanding about what you said, you know, it's recorded.
Yeah.
And we can verify the record that way. The most interesting case is with one of Dashiell Hammett's daughters, who I was interviewing about Lillian Hellman, and called her up on the phone. I didn't have her address at the time. I got her phone number from another biographer. And she was very reluctant to be interviewed. And I said, well, you know, this was in California. And I said, I've flown out from Detroit to do some work in archives and I'm talking to anybody I can. And I dropped some names, you know, I said, I spoke with Lee Gershwin, Ira Gershwin's wife. And so I had to give her, you know, some sense of who I was. I was a professor, et cetera. And after my sort of introduction of myself, she says, well, okay. So I drove over to her place and came in and did what I usually do. I set my recording device on the table and she looked at that and she said, oh no, I can't be recorded. And I said, oh, okay, sure. Yeah, I said, you don't mind if I take notes? And she said, no. So I started to ask her things and I started to tell her things that I had learned about Lillian Hellman. And many of them she did not know, and she became quite interested. Mm-hmm. And this went on for about an hour, and said, you know, I'm really getting hungry. Some lunch. Do you want to have some lunch? Yeah. Sure. So we sat down at the lunch table off of her kitchen, and I noticed on the top of the refrigerator there was a shoebox. And I said, actually, I didn't say anything to her. She looked up at the shoebox, and she knew I was eyeing it. And she said, you know, in the box there are Lillian Hellman's letters.
Oh.
And I said, well, would you mind bringing down the shoebox? So she put the shoebox on the table. And I said, you know, what would be really great is if you read those letters into my recorder. And you could comment on them. And she said, oh, okay. She read all of these letters into the recorder with her comments about them. You know, it was just fantastic.
Oh, that's actually.
She kept in touch with me. I mean, we became good friends. You know, she got involved in a book contract project and wanted my advice. And you know, it was all great.
I wonder if nowadays, because, you know, in the news, there's endlessly clips of various politicians or policemen or whatever, you know, being played, being retrieved from cell phones and being played. I wonder if this, however, makes people more anxious about what they say and how it might be used.
I think some people. Yeah, I think some people are, but they get so used to the technology. I think they, you know, as when I put my recorder on the table, there may be some initial reluctance. But once the conversation gets flowing, that lessens. I'm sure for some people, it's a real deal breaker and they're worried and they, you know, they're using browsers now that, you know, promise not to track them and so on. So some people are very... very concerned about their privacy. I'm just the opposite because I want where I am. And so I never know when someone might contact me with something really interesting. I've never understood why biographers were so secretive about their story. Do they really think if they tell me I'm working on so-and-so, I'm going to go out and steal their subject and write a proposal and get a, you know, it's not so easy to write a proposal and get a publisher anyway. And so I'm going to go to the trouble of stealing what they're working on. I think it's just ridiculous. For me, it's you could do blab as much as possible. And so many times talking about my work, people have said, oh, I know somebody who knows somebody, you know, and I get something really good out of it. So I don't close up that way.
Yeah, and you've managed to make it, keep it very friendly. I've dealt with women in particular in their 80s and 90s who have, you know, I've made friends with, but I think they would have had a hard time if I'd been recording. That would have reminded them that it was.
One of the things I do before I put that recorder on the table is try to make them real contact with people. Also to give them the feeling, and it's genuine on my part, that they are collaborators, that I'm not just trying to get something out of them. And that's why I try to tell them about things I've learned, things that they couldn't possibly know because they're not in books or art, and they're new material. And again, I think some biographers would be afraid, well, that's my material. I don't want anybody else to know about it. You know, because, well, who are they going to tell? It just doesn't make any sense to me to restrict.
So you really are building up both rapport and trust.
Yeah. And I do say to them, and a lot of biographers don't like to do this, especially ones trained as journalists. I do say to them that anything I use that you tell me, you'll get a chance to look at it in a draft chapter or book or whatever. You know, you'll have that chance. What I don't say to them is, of course, unless it's a factual matter, I'm not giving them the right to change what I write, you know, to give a different version of it. But I never say that. And most of the time, they don't ask for that.
How do you actually do that? How do you manage that process of showing?
I just tell them I'm going to send it to them. And most times, there's no quarrel about it. They don't ask for changes unless I get a date wrong or a fact wrong. The funniest example is when I interviewed Diana Trilling, who I don't think would have allowed an interview without a recording because she wanted to protect herself.
And actually
I interviewed her several times for several books. And the first time was for Lillian Hellman. She had a friendship with Hellman and then a falling out. And she was very eager to talk about that. But the funny thing was, I sent her the chapter that included all of her remarks about Lillian Hellman. And she sent back the chapter, and there were lots of comments on it. Mainly, she wanted to clarify some of the things that she said. I had no objection to that. You know, it's not a tape recorder book. I want her best thought out in the best language possible, her comments on it. So that didn't bother me at all. That was fine. And then she went on to edit the rest of the chapter. She said to me, she said, she was still calling me Mr. Rollison. She said, Mr. Rollison, I hope you'll forgive me, but I read the whole chapter and I think, you know, that some of these changes might be useful to you. And she was right. I accepted her changes.
So that's fabulous, actually. Some people can't help themselves.
That's essentially what she said.
But how do you interview a very large number of people rather than just relying on some biographers? It's something I've become kind of cross about, who just rely on paper documents and seem to believe every paper document they pick up. But you interview tons, you know, sometimes dozens and dozens of people. How can you let them all check over everything that you've used that comes from them?
Well, you know, some people, even though I make the offer, and then I tell them, you know, I'm you know, the book is I'm getting ready to publish the book. They don't ask to see it.
I see. So
the interesting thing about, in other words, I haven't sent it to everybody because not everybody wants to see it, and I'm not sure why that is exactly. With Walter Brennan's family, for example, I several times said to the family members I interviewed, you know, you're perfectly welcome to look at this. And that's a funny story. They none of them cared. That is, they cared very much about Walter Brennan, and they had been very suspicious. They wouldn't cooperate with anybody. Mm-hmm. But a close friend of theirs vouched for me, and then I went to where most of them lived, which was in Joseph, Oregon, where Walter Brennan had a cattle ranch. And I talked to a lot of them, and just I really got along with them. I really liked them as people. The funniest thing was, after the book did come out, I made another trip to Joseph, Oregon, because we had a big event. I had written a play about Brennan, too, which was performed there. And the family was very pleased with that, too. But one of his grandsons came up to me, and he said, "You know, I read your book." He said, "It's very good." He said, "But I think you spent too much time on the movies." I was really surprised.
You talk to families, you talk to friends, you talk to colleagues, and you talk to the help.
Yeah, I love talking to the help. Yeah.
And I found that interesting because I'm writing about Valerie Elliott. I worked as her secretary when I was young. And the first
You are the help, Karen.
I am the help. I am the help. And I looked at that and I thought of the first time I met the Elliott Estates executor, and she said, basically said, "How dare you?"
Yeah.
About her. I had already written a big feature in The Guardian, but it was a "How dare you?"
Yeah.
Help.
You're not worthy enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that too. Yeah. I got that with Susan Sontag's agent when my wife and I were doing the biography. She said, "Who are these people? I never heard of them." Well, that was sort of the point. You know, you don't want a biography by someone in Sontag's circle. They're, you know, I looked at her archive. I could see the way they treated her. They never, you know, very rarely did they level with her in any way. So what good is that?
And you've talked to all sorts of people. I noticed with Rebecca West at the end of her life, she had various people helping her and secretaries.
Yeah.
And she, like as Valerie Elliott did, confided in. They were the people who were there.
That's right. They, in some ways, your subjects, like Rebecca West, unbend. They've got nothing at stake when they're talking to the hairdresser or the cleaner.
So the young and you know, I was the young person, the young mother. She, you know, chatted.
Yeah,
I was the one who was there.
Yeah,
and the idea that you wouldn't, that some people would say, "Oh, it's just the help. Why would I talk to them?" You really made me think about that more, more closely. Look at that more closely.
I wanted to talk to a fellow who cleaned Susan Sontag's apartment, and I learned this again by blabbing when I lived in Brooklyn in the elevator. Somebody asked me in the building I lived, "What was I working on?" And I said, "Susan Sontag." And he said, "Oh, I know the guy who used to clean her apartment." And I said, "Well, can you put me in touch with that?"
That's like the best, actually.
Yeah. And I wasn't successful. That is, the guy wouldn't talk to me. Uh-huh. And later, when people started attacking the biography, and when Sontag had another biographer, they said, "You know, this is how," I can't remember what word they used, venal or whatever, Rollison was. He wanted to talk to the person who cleaned Sontag's apartment, you know, which made me into, you know, this, I don't know what, scum, you know. I was interested in a lot more than that in Sontag, but I was interested in that too. You know, memoirs have come out after she died where people talk about her eating habits.
Mm-hmm.
But if a biographer does that, especially when the subject is alive, oh my God. You know, what you've done is sacrilege. You know, it's horrible what you did. You know, they just wait until the person dies and then they spill the beans. The person who, you know, I'll just mention this. I interviewed Agnes DeMille, who is a friend of Rebecca West.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to DeMille's apartment in the NYU area. And on her shelf, was a picture of her husband, and she had come out with herself a biography of Martha Graham. And she said to me, like one biographer to another, she said, sort of voce, she said, "You know, I waited till she died. Wasn't that sneaky?" I thought, this is the person for me.
Yes. And this the word you just used was sacrilege.
Yeah.
And that's certainly, when it comes to T.S. Eliot, that
is certainly
what one encounters. In fact, he was jokingly called during his lifetime the Pope of Russell Square.
That's right. There he is, situated on Parnassus. Yeah.
Yes. And it comes up all the time, the how dare you, you know, on another level. And I assume that that's something that you've encountered. Probably not Marilyn Monroe had been much written about, but with Rebecca West or Martha Keller, you know, the people who, and how about with Michael Foote?
Yes, well, Michael Foote was a Labour Party icon in Britain.
Yeah.
And when I lived with him off and on for 3 years, every time I came to London, I stayed with him. Then I was working on a biography of his wife, Jill Craigie, which I published. And then because I had all these recordings with him, I decided to do a second book called A Private Life of Michael Foote. Now, what happened was people would visit the house that he knew that I would interview about him and Jill. I traveled with him to his constituency in Wales. I traveled with him to his hometown in Plymouth. I traveled with him to Dubrovnik, where he liked a holiday with Jill, and kept doing that after she died. In a lot of places, in his hometown Plymouth, for example, we visited relatives, and one relative said to me, "Well, what happens if Michael doesn't?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, Michael knows it's my book. He doesn't like it, you know. He can, a friendship, or kick me out of the house. It doesn't change what I'm going to write." People didn't believe me. They believed, because I traveled with him, because I stayed in his house, that I was a biographer.
Or a disciple of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he took me everywhere. He touted Rebecca West book. So people sort of assumed, and usually they didn't question, you know, the fact, well, independent. How could he be independent? Because he's traveling around with this guy. But I was independent in spite of all that. People knew that. I don't know what he told other people when I wasn't around. But from the first day on the steps of his house, when we started talking about the idea of doing a biography of his wife, I said, "Now, you know, it's my book." He said, "Oh, yeah, it's your book. It's your book." I said, "I'll show you what I write." And I did. I said, but I'm the one who has to be in control. "No problem. No problem." You know, but, you know, when the book came out, his nephew, because of certain things in the book, wrote to me, and he said I had abused Michael's. Well, that's just got it all wrong. That's not.
Yes.
Michael was a very hospitable person, but he.
But it wasn't a trade. You weren't.
No.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting that family reacted so strongly when Michael Foote had read your Rebecca West biography, which is very frank. It's admiring, to me, it's admiring, but also very frank about all kinds of just ordinary aspects of life, especially those, you know, her last days. I mean, just the sort of misery of being very old and struggling.
Yes.
and getting close to death. Not a pretty picture, but a powerful one. How could someone read that and then think you're going to do a sort of bland and unnuanced and always, you know, Pollyanna-ish?
The answer there is in question. That is, those people didn't read Rebecca West's biography.
Mm-hmm.
So they had no idea. There was one architect who was a friend of hers who came over the house one time. We got to talking about Jill and so on. And then he went into really almost, he wasn't needling me. He was very in a very friendly way. He was obviously curious. How was I going to do this book, given that, you know, I was, in a sense, so close. There were days when I got up in the morning in his house, we had breakfast together, and we're together for most of the whole. And then at night, we'd have dinner together, and I'd practically tuck him in. And so some people knew this, sort of cross-examining me in a friendly way about, can you really do this? Can you be this close to someone and at the same time be independent? That doesn't, for most people, I think that would be very difficult. You know, that would be a betrayal of confidences. The thing about that is, again, right from the very start, essentially, I told him, no matter what you do or say, no matter way, but the implication was no matter how friendly this all is, and no matter how much hospitality there is, write what I want to write, what I think is, you know, correct. It's funny the way people read biographies. Biographer Mervyn Jones, the son of Ernest Jones, the famous biographer of Freud. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed Mervyn because he knew Michael. And the first thing he said to me, he had read my Rebecca Woods biography. And he said, you did prove something that I've said can't be done. And I said, what's that, Mervyn? And he said, you've written about somebody, a good book, he said, about somebody you don't like. And I was floored. Because I love West. I absolutely loved her. And I was shocked that someone could read that biography and think that ultimately like my subject. That's, you know, up until that point, when people ask me, what is your favorite book? I said, well, that's tough because you like all your books. But really, working on Rebecca West, both as a biographical subject and as a person, I just loved it.
That certainly is the impression I have, because that's one that I've just this week been reading. And I had read Rebecca West, a couple of her best known books when I was young, and sort of knew of her. But you really made, I certainly felt that you loved, that you admired her, that you found her just, you know, fascinating, just a really, really interesting character. And you wanted your readers to share that.
Yeah.
There's plenty that wasn't, you know, it was sort of rough, but
yeah.
Boy, what a powerful, impressive character she was.
Yeah. My big fear going into the book was there was a split in the family. And again, this was about money. When she died, she gave the bulk of her estate to her nephew, Norman MacLeod, not to her son, Anthony West. And this created a great deal of, division, anger in the family. And there were essentially two sets of West relatives, so to speak. Anthony's wife, second wife, was in America, Lily. And the first one was in England. And anyway, there were all kinds of complications, and I thought, I'm going to get hammered from both sides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just the opposite happened. Now, why didn't either side of the family get angry? And to this day, I'm friends with the family,
mm-hmm.
Both sides of the family. Why didn't I get hammered one way or the other? Well, I hope I wrote a fair book. That's one question. But the other thing about Rebecca was, and there is a dark side to Rebecca West, which, as you sort of indicated, is in the book as well. One of the things that I finally realized is she had managed, didn't matter who got the money and who didn't get the money in this sense, she had managed to insult every single person in her family. So when they read this book, they could say, ah, yes, that's the Rebecca I know.
And it wasn't just me. She was like that to everybody.
Yeah, it turns out it wasn't just me. It turns out she could be like that with anybody.
Now, you have written a lot of biographies of women, certainly not all, but yes. You have taken on women as your subjects quite often. Are there any patterns there? One of the things that struck me is how much you probe beneath the surface stories or the myths around people. I was thinking about this where you talked about how cannily women, I think you were talking about Gellhorn. I think that's where I made that note. Cannily, she made her way into the world, but women have often wanted it to look like they weren't ambitious, or they didn't want, other people didn't want to read them as having been ambitious. But you definitely have seen that and looked for that in their stories. Am I correct about that? And can you?
Yes, yes. These are all very ambitious women who in many cases don't want the ambition to show. And therefore a biography, if they're still alive, like Martha Gellhorn, or Sontag, it's very upsetting to show, in a sense, how the sausage is made. What also attracts me about biographies of women, and up until I did my Norma Mailer biography in the early 1990s, I had only done biographies of women, and I used to joke about that and say, you know, I only did Mailer because I wanted to prove I could write about a man. You know, it's one thing to be, say, Arthur Miller playwright. It's another thing to be Lillian Hellman playwright, if you're a woman. And you're dealing in most of your professional life with some women, but mostly with men. And therefore, how you comport yourself. Hellman is fascinating because she gave up nothing as a woman in terms of her, you know, her sex life, her interest in womanly things. You know, she was a great cook. She had a great sense of fashion. And she was also tough as nails.
Mm-hmm.
And that combination is just, when you look at what women have to put up with what most men have to put up with, I guess, unless maybe they're gay or have some other kind of disability, women win, hands down.
Mm-hmm.
They just have more to negotiate.
Yes.
And one of the things I'm very happy about is, I think I'm right in this, all of my biographies of women have been edited by women, starting with my wife.
Uh-huh.
And that's always been very important to me. I haven't sought it out. It's almost by accident. You know, if my Rebecca West, which the American publisher was Scribner, was edited by a woman who was then fired and ultimately was edited by a man. But I've always relied, in a sense, on my wife's sense. You don't know my wife, but anyone who does know my wife knows she would not stand for any nonsense from me. Certainly,
I give her much credit for your work on women.
certainly, you know, nothing approaching sexism at all. One of the reasons I wanted to do a biography with her, with Sontag, is because I knew, to go back to interviewing, I knew that there would be some women I would be interviewing and some men as well, actually. Where it would be easier if she was in the room.
Yes.
If one of us was, in a sense, casing the joint while the other one was asking questions.
Yes.
Or if she was asking questions and I was casing the joint.
Mm-hmm. But you've found this ambition, and it's often kind of things that were, you know, kind of behind the curtain. Starting with Marilyn Monroe, who you wanted to show a side of her and her capacity as an actor and just as someone who is kind of creating a life for herself that I think was, I find that very interesting because I see you trying to do that in other books and actually, and writing about the ways in which things, you know, women's ambitions were tamped down by their relationships. Jill Craigie is an interesting example.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you want to say something? Yeah. I'm very fond. I've become very fond of Jill Craigie. So I want I'd like to hear you talk a bit about her.
I would put a plug too in for the audio book, which the narrator is just fantastic. She did it really as a labor of love. I was very lucky to get her. And so Jill's voice really comes through in that book when she's quoted. Jill is interesting because she came from nothing. She wasn't a college graduate. She married, her second husband was in the film industry. Jill had done some journalism. She had started out as what the British call an agony aunt, you know, like a deer
yes.
sort of thing. But she had covered events. She had got interested in the suffragists. And this second husband was a screenwriter, and she wrote some scripts with him, and she got involved in the script industry. Beautiful woman. She started doing documentaries and got a lot of good press. Very tough in the British film industry for a woman. There were a few women around. Jill was not the first, but it was a very, very hard way to make a living. And when she was doing a documentary about Plymouth at the end of the war, The Way We Live, she met Michael Foot, and he appears briefly in that film, and she fell in love with him. She was interested in causes, she essentially, after she met him, is essentially, although she did some journalism and she did some film, she became devoted to him as a Labour Party politician, really as a Labour Party icon. He introduced her to all sorts of people, both in politics, but in general, in the cultural life of England. And she really became absorbed in that life. And I think it became hard for her, even though she clung to her name, Jill Craigie, to keep her own identity, given his sort of massive kind of fame. And the biography is in part about that struggle of hers and her desire to be a feminist, and yet how difficult that was. And it was especially difficult with Michael Foot because he seemed such an obliging, such a sociable, such a sensitive man. And he would sometimes refer to him as a feminist, and certainly in terms of his politics, you could call him a feminist. But as a husband, he was no feminist.
You quote some comments, I can't remember if it was from her letter or diaries, about how much men eat or depend on those regular meals.
Yes.
And
yes.
I can really relate to that. I thought so many women, that our life ends up being, our schedule determined by the men folk are waiting for a meal. And it's not that they're demanding it. No, no, no. But it would never happen if we didn't do it.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's what it was like with Michael. I mean, he was not brutal. He was, you know, he didn't order her around. He seemed to be giving her a lot of leeway. And yet, when he was home, I don't think he even realized how many demands he was making on her. And when I suggested this in my biography of Jill Craigie, he went ballistic because he had this entirely different view of himself. And that's so fascinating because it depends so much on the person. You know, Thomas Carlyle, who was a lot more obstreperous and choleric than Michael Foot ever was, and who certainly gave his wife, Jane Carlyle, a hard time, when his biographer, James Anthony Froude, began to write about that marriage, Carlyle was grief-stricken. He suddenly realized what a monster he had been. And I guess somewhere in the back of my mind, I thought Michael might see that there was some of that Carlyle in him, unintentionally, but that was also there. But he didn't. I had so offended his own, Jill had died, his own, you know, burnished memories of life with Jill, that what I wrote was, it was just intolerable. He didn't mind that I wrote about his affairs, but when I didn't write about his marriage exactly the way he saw it, he was very upset.
Well, I was impressed because I felt that somehow you were capturing an aspect of a woman's experience that is hard to, and that's what I'm saying is that to understand that, I think you bridge something really important there. That's, and that's a challenge. Sometimes I think I have heard that, you know, well, women should write about women. But you certainly seem to manage that from my point of view. And I attribute that to your wife's good influence.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Well, you know, we could go on and on and on. It's been almost an hour.
Yes, yes.
And I don't want to cut you off, Karen. We can always do this.
No. I think this covered a lot of the territory I wanted to cover with you. I think it will be helpful to other people to think through and then look at some of the things that you've done, because you've dealt with some very challenging biographical subjects.
Well, thank you very much. It was wonderful of you to suggest this.
Great, great. Really fun for me too. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much, Karen.
Take care.
Bye-bye.